Anyway, this is the record. I promise you it might be a little bit longer than you hoped it would be, but I thought while I was about it I'd do the whole history briefly of my family, because one day you might find this interesting. I thought it better. For instance, when I talk about my mummy, I'm talking about my mother, who is your great-grandmother. And when I talk about daddy, I'm talking about my father, who is your great-grandfather. I'll probably not get to any point when I talk about your mummy, because I'll stop when probably before I get married, talk about things before I got married. So, and then when I talk about grandma, I'm talking about my grandmother, who is my mother's mother, your great-grandma. I hope this isn't too confusing. So, starting with mummy's family, she was one of five children. She had two sisters and three brothers. Her two older brothers were in the First World War. Her oldest sister was a dressmaker. She was called Winnie. Her two older brothers were called Harry and Edward. And then there was a long pause, and then she was born, and her little brother, who was called Harold, my mother was called Ivy, and their surname was Watts. They lived in Nailsworth in Gloucestershire, where my mother was born, and where her mother also was born, but uphill in Pinfarthing's little village at the top of the hill. Nailsworth is in quite a deep valley, and all along the valley, it was called the Stroud Valley actually, there were woolen mills, because it was very famous for its wool. So there were probably, I don't know, a dozen huge woolen mills, and they employed practically everybody who lived in the area. So my grandpa, my mother's father, he came into the area. He was actually a farmer's son. He was born in near Froom, and not very far away. He was, because he wasn't the oldest son, he wouldn't inherit the farm, and his parents apprenticed him to I think it was something like a grocer or something like that, which he absolutely hated, so he decided to take off. So he came down to work in the woolen mills, and that's where he met my grandma, who was a very handsome man. She was a very pretty lady, and he was quite a card. He was always playing practical jokes on people. I remember Mummy telling us that when she was little, she can always remember him having sort of jokes on them. For instance, once she found her doll sitting on the lavatory and that sort of thing. And also, they were some of the first people to have a gramophone. That was a big wind-up gramophone with a huge horn. They were quite famous for having it. And he used to take it down to the pub in the evenings under his arm with a horn on his head like a hat. He was also quite a militant man, and when he got a bit mixed up in trying to get fair wages for the people who worked in the mills, because of course they were exploited quite a lot, and he was sacked, and it was put about that nobody else was to employ him because he was a troublemaker. My mummy said that she can remember that she was just a little girl sitting on the stairs listening to her parents talking, and grandma was saying to him, never mind, you know you've done the right thing, so you know you don't have anything to sort of feel guilty about not being able to get a job. But in fact, because he was a farmer's son and a sort of great countryman, he was a wonderful gardener. And because of all the huge mills along the valley, there were also lots of huge houses belonging to the owners of the mills, and also foremen and people who had higher jobs. So there were some beautiful houses all around, and they all had beautiful gardens. And so he got a job as gardener, and he used to garden for the big houses, and that was what he did for the rest of his working life. And my grandma Watts was quite unusual in that she always worked. Her father had died when she was quite young. He was a wheelwright, my great-grandpa. But he died when he was young and left left the family with quite a few children. I can't remember how many exactly. So they all had to work as soon as they could to help out. And so she'd always been used to working. And she was working in a little factory that was just opposite where they used to live. It was called Walkers. Funnily enough, they had walking sticks, rather beautiful walking sticks for the gentry. And she was an expert at in the little place where they, after the walking sticks had been lacquered, she made they made patterns on them, made them look like wood grain, and that was what she did. And so she always worked. So it was just opposite where they used to live. So, and some of the three older children were quite grown up. Used to look after Grandma and Uncle Howard when they came home from school. So that was okay. And she was, I think she was quite happy. They were a very happy family. Just up the road in Worcester, which one day I'll take you to see because it's all lovely, or Mummy might, your Mummy, there's a huge Dominican monastery. It was quite an important one at the time. There were about, I should think, probably 30 monks, and it was also the novitiate, so that they used to get sort of 20 or so novices every year in the first year of being Dominican monks. There was also a little primary school called St Dominic's, which is still there. And that's where Mummy and Uncle Howard went to school. So they weren't Catholics, but the whole valley was slightly dominated by this big monastery because everybody knew them and knew the monks and everything. And even Catholics, non-Catholics went to this little primary school, which was the local school for all the small children. And so they've been brought up, although they weren't Catholics, they were brought up in quite a Catholic atmosphere. And that's where Mummy and Uncle Howard went to school. Always used to make me laugh because that Mummy was quite a very pretty little girl, very, very spoiled because she was the youngest of the big family. And she and Uncle Harold had a sort of running battle with him. There was about 2 years between them, I think. She used to tell tales on him at school. She used to call him Harold Watts. And it always used to make us laugh because she said that one day she put her hand up and said, "Please, Miss Harold Watts has made a smell." Anyway, that was their sort of a relationship to each other, rather, let me think now, what's the word, always trying to get one off on each other. But anyhow, when because her older brothers were much older than that, her, they were both in the First World War, and they were both soldiers. But before the war, Uncle Harry, one of her brothers, married an Irish girl called Josephine, and he brought her over to England. Of course, she was a very strong Catholic, and when she came, when she met the family and when they were married, she said to him, "Why, you know, the children might as well be Catholics because they've been brought up by the monks and in the Catholic atmosphere at school." So they became Catholic. Mummy and Uncle Harold and Uncle Harry. I don't think Aunt Winnie never did. Neither did Uncle Eddie, but. And then, and also, Grandma Watts became a Catholic, but not Grandpa Watts. He did become a Catholic, but not until much later when he was very ill and dying, and the priest used to come visit him, and eventually he became Catholic. But so, that was that story. Another story that I always thought was terribly sweet was when Grandma, I think she had measles or something like that, my mother had measles. And she was in bed, and their little cottage looked out onto the road, which was now it's quite a big main road, but then it was just a sort of a very rough road between Knowsworth and Stroud, which was the nearest big town, the next nearest big town. And she said she was lying in bed with quite a high temperature, and everyone was making a big fuss of her. And her mother was downstairs, Grandma Watt, and suddenly she saw an elephant go past her bedroom window. Just the top half of this elephant walked past, and she thought she was seeing things, so she called, Mam, come here. So her mother came running up and said, "I've just seen an elephant going by the window," thinking her mother would just say, "Oh no, darling, you know, it's just because you've got a high temperature." But in fact, it was the circus coming to Knowsworth, and in those days, and the circus used to travel about, I think mostly by train, and with big special trucks on the trains. And then when they got to the nearest station, they used to decamp all the all the animals and lions in their cages and things like that, pulled by horses. But the elephant always used to lead the parade, the elephant and the circus, and that's what she's seen going by the window. I thought that was a terribly sweet story. So they grew up in this rather idyllic way. They used to have lots of fun playing around in the countryside. There's no danger of being run over by cars or anything. But Grandma, my mummy, was very good at the piano. She used to take piano lessons, and Nails was just up the road. And when she was about, I think, 10 or 11, I'm not quite sure what age she was, one of the aunties died, and they left her parents some money. And her teacher at her school, at this little primary school where she went, said to her parents, "Why don't you buy her piano?" So they did, and we had that piano right up until, oh, I don't know, I was married. So we always had it. Wherever we went, the piano came with us. And and also they decided to send her away to school because she was the youngest and all the others were away and her parents were working and everything. So she went to a boarding school in Manchester with nuns, and that's where she stayed there, and then she came down to a nearer one in Cheltenham until she was 18. So she was all the way at school, and gradually lost her very broad Gloucestershire accent, which the rest of her family never did. Actually, it was a beautiful accent, but she lost hers, and that's probably why we speak like we do. Otherwise, we'd all have lovely Gloucestershire accents. Then when she came here from school, she started to teach in this little primary school. And while they were there, a new head teacher came down from London called Phyllis White. But Grandma was a rather ravishing 18, 19-year-old. She was very pretty always, and because her sister was a dressmaker, she was always in the very latest fashions. And when they were going to have an armistice parade, this is probably about 1921, it was put about that this teacher who moved down with her family from London and was living in Aylesworth had a brother who'd been in the war and was going to lay the wreath on a new memorial to the fallen of the 1914-18 war. And so this rather handsome man came along also in very fashionably dressed, because he was from London and everyone with a bit of gog. And that was turned out to be my buddy, and they met and fell in love, and got married about 2 years later, and then we were all born. And that we by that time, when they got married, we moved over to Brimscombe, which is a little village on the other side of the valley, and that's where Lisa and I were born. Valerie and Mary were born in Aylesworth. By the time I was born, both my grandparents had died. My grandfather of Grandpa Watts died of cancer. Grandma Watts died of a heart attack. They were both only in their early 60s. So I never knew them, but I just knew them by all the lovely stories Mummy used to tell us about them. And then in about 19... I can remember lots of things when we lived in Brimscombe, which was the name of the village where we were born, although I was only 4, I think, when we moved away. My father, that he never really, like a lot of people after the First World War, never managed to get a proper job. They were all supposed to come back to glory and beautiful work, but he never really got anything satisfactory. By this time there were 4 of us, so he had a lot of us to keep. Then he saw an advertisement that said that you could sell hoovers. You needed a car to do it, and it was in Bristol, which was a city about, I don't know, 30 miles away from us then. So he applied for this job and got it, and this was going to be the great making of this. We were all going to move to Bristol. But because we were very poor, he had to borrow some money to buy a car. I think he borrowed £12 off his sister, and we all moved to Bristol, where we lived in a flat. Quite a big flat, I think it had at least 3 bedrooms, and I remember it very well, although I was only quite small. We moved there in about 1937, so by this time war was looming a bit, and because my father was the way he was a very bookish man and a bit of a dreamer. Of course, I didn't think he ever sold a single hoover, and we were terribly We were terribly poor. They were just about managing to scrape by with all of us. And I think it cost as much to Gower as a car as it cost to feed us, practically. And so then in 1938, when war was inevitable, he enlisted again. He'd been in the First World War all the way through. He'd fought in the First World War in the trenches in France. So he was quite... I mean, he was one of the very few people I would think who'd been out there for the whole time and had survived. Well, he was wounded once in the shoulder, but when it was better, he was sent back to front again. So he thought the thing to do would be to enlist in the army again. So in 1938 he did, and that was a bit of a turning point in our finances, because it meant that we had a bit of money again, and he was able to carry on. Then in 1939, of course, war was declared, and I can remember Lisa and I looking out of our bedroom window and seeing big searchlights moving across the sky and saying to Mummy, "What's that?" And she said, "Oh, it's just fireworks, darling, there's nothing to worry about." But actually nothing happened for quite a long time, and but we were living in Bristol, which was considered to be quite a dangerous place when the bombing started, because it was quite an important city. So it was decided that we should move out of Bristol, because it wasn't a very good place to be. And we moved, and we moved down to Somerset to live in the same village as my Auntie Phil did, the same Auntie Phil who was the headmistress at the school in St. Dominic. She got married and now lived in a village called Old Cleve in Somerset. And we rented a tiny little cottage. By this time Jenny had been born, so there were five of us. And we were just this tiny little cottage with one room downstairs and a scullery, a lavatory down the garden, which we were always terrified of going to at night, and two bedrooms. Did I say that? Two bedrooms? Or so that's where we went to live. But it was a beautiful little cottage, and it was a lovely setting, a lovely village, and considered to be pretty safe, and not very far away from Bristol, actually. I have talked all about Mummy's family, but I suppose because we lived in the area that she was born, and I was most familiar with her life and her family, because ours was somewhat similar. But my father was a Londoner. He was a great... his parents moved down to Nailsworth because they had a shop, and it didn't work very well, so they had to sell up. And so Auntie Phil had a friend who lived in Nailsworth, and she said, "Why don't you come down here?" And my grandpa got a job as a clerk in the big factory called Chamberlain's, which wasn't a woolen mill. I don't think it probably was in those days. It changed later on. And so that's how they came down to live in Nailsworth. But actually they were London people, absolutely through and through. They were they used to go to all the shows and music halls. They knew all the latest things, always wore all the latest fashions. They had a big circle of friends and they were always sort of going on picnics and romps, and we've got photograph albums with various cousins and uncles and dogs and goodness knows what all. So they were a very different family from my mother's family. They couldn't have been more different, really. They were like the country mouse and the town mouse lot. And my father was a wonderful musician. He was he played the violin as a child. When he got older, he could play practically anything, but he used to play the tenor saxophone and a lot of wind instruments. He was a wonderful sight reader, and one of the jobs he had between the wars was playing in dance bands, and most exciting ones, he used to play in dance bands on the big liners that used to go between England and America, which in those days was a very, very glamorous thing that only very rich people could do. And he played in those bands, but he did that for a couple of years, and then he stopped that because it meant that he was away from home for ages, and Mummy was having her babies and things, and was quite... that used to bring home to my mother the most wonderful stories. And they always had We always knew all the latest songs, because they used to get them from America. Daddy used to get them because they used to play them in bands. So he used to teach them all to us. So we always knew all the latest songs. Mummy was also a lovely musician, and they used to play a lot. And I know this is the sort of thing that people say, oh, we used to sing around the piano, but we really, really did. From the time I can ever remember, when I was tiny, tiny, we all used to stand around singing, and we used to play, and we used to perform to each other, and everything. And then that Mary learnt the piano as well, and then later on. So we always had masses and masses of music everywhere, modern music, all latest things in the dance bands, and all the classical piano music and everything. So our heads were full of it, absolutely full. Daddy had a sister and brother, Uncle Tudor and Auntie Phil. Auntie Phil, as I said, we saw a lot of later on, because we all moved into the same village. But Uncle Tudor stayed in London. He's married to a lady called Louie, and they had two children, Anne and John, and they of course were white, because that was my grandfather. That was my father's name and mine until I got married. And they always stayed in London. They were the sort of London part of the family, something that was quite alien to us, really. I don't think I went to London when I was 18. No, I did. I went when I was 11 to it with a school friend once, but otherwise we just were very country people. Actually, Lily, I said that we moved straight from Bristol to Peabody, but we didn't. In fact, we went to live in Dorset for a year and a half, and in between times rented a lovely cottage there in a place called Shillingston, and that's where Jenny was born. So we lived there for a year and a half, and then we moved Somerset to O'Keefe, and really, I suppose that's when our war began, and when my most vivid memories are of what it was like living through it. Although we weren't involved in it, and it was very much part of our lives, and also it was a very happy time. We lived, the five of us lived in this little cottage. Daddy was away, but he used to come home on leave, and I don't know, although terrible things were happening in the world, for us we were living a rather sort of idyllic childhood. And Auntie Phil, who lived in a big house about a mile away, had living with her, because we were living in the country, moved to the country from the city if they could. She had her own four children, Roger, Elizabeth, Anthony and Monica. And then she had Anne and John White from London living with her for a bit because of all the bombing in London. And then she also had she wasn't an aunt, but she was a great friend called Dora, who was a lovely musician, a beautiful pianist. She was staying with her daughter Kathleen, and all the husbands were away, of course, and parents. So it was just like a sort of huge group of cousins and children living in this village. I can't remember the winters at all. All I can remember are the beautiful summers. So I think that's what often happens. But our whole throughout everything that was happening, we knew that there was the war going on, and for us it was a little bit of a game, actually, because you always think your parents are going to keep you safe and nothing's ever going to happen to you. So that's how we felt. So we just carried on with life with all these cousins who lived just down the road, and our adored little sister Jenny, who we all made a terrible fuss of, took with us everywhere we went. And I'll tell you about all that. I'm going to have a little pause. Two things I remember, actually, before we went to live in Somerset. One of them happened when we were still living in Bristol at the beginning of the war. There was a movement to send children to America or South Africa and Australia, I think, to get them out of the sort of way of the war until the war was over. And to do this, you had to have a medical examination. And Daddy and Mummy thought that they might send us, because when in the First World War, Daddy's brother had been sent to some relatives in South Africa, and he'd lived with them for the duration of the war. But anyway, I can remember going down to this big sort of centre where there was a doctor with a stethoscope around his neck, and we all had to get down to our best knickers and stand up and be sort of weighed and measured, and then he listened to our hearts and made sure we were fit to go to be transported off in these huge ships to either, I think we were going to go to America. Anyway, we went home, and then Mummy decided that she didn't want to send me because I was her baby at the time. And so it was going to be just Mary and Berenice who were going to go. But then something happened, I can't quite remember exactly, but I think one of the ships that was taking the children to America was torpedoed, and a lot of people were killed, so they decided they weren't going to do it anymore. The programme was just stopped completely. So they didn't go after all. But I was at home alone in Bristol, because Lissa and Mary and Valerie were boarders at the time at St Rose's, where in Stroud, where we used to live. They'd stayed on as boarders in the school where they were day girls. So I was just me and Mummy in that set of Bristol for a lot of the time, except during the holidays. That's one of the things I remember at the very beginning of the war that happened in Bristol. And the other thing that happened was when we were living in this place called Shillingston, which I told you about, it was in Dorset, so it was on the sort of coast or route between the airplanes and places that we were trying to get into. We used to see the bombs going over, and because it was all rather still vague, we thought it was all rather exciting. I remember standing outside the house watching these great fleets of bombers going across the sky. They used to make a funny noise, they went like that. It was a very familiar noise as the war went on, hearing the bombers going, our bombers going over to them and their bombers coming over to us. And the other thing I remember is standing on outside the house watching what we used to call a dog fight. It was two airplanes, a German plane and a British plane, fighters whizzing around shooting at each other, just watching it on the road with all the village, thinking how exciting it was. It was quite high up. And at school we had, in the playground, they dug a big trench, and if there was an air raid warning, we had to go and out and fire into this trench and stand there. And I can remember once when there was a warning, us all going out and standing in this trench. And did I say it was deep enough for us to stand up in? And we watched an aeroplane actually crashing above us, a fighter. I don't know whether it was German or English, I can't remember actually, but I do remember I think the pilot had bailed out, so nobody was killed. But I remember Daddy taking us up afterwards onto the hillside somewhere and showing us the wreck of this aeroplane that had come down. Another time in the same village, I was at home from school. I think I wasn't well, so Mummy kept me home from school. And we were looking out of her bedroom window, and we saw this aeroplane going, this German aeroplane going across, a big cross on its side. And suddenly we said, look, it's throwing out its empty milk bottles, but in fact they were bombs. And we saw this string of bombs coming down and exploding, and a huge explosion in a field beyond the village. And I can remember the earth coming up as high as the aeroplane. And what used to happen is when they'd been on a bombing raid, they would, on the way back, this aeroplane was obviously in trouble because it was quite low, they would get rid of all their bombs and ammunition so that if they had to make a crash landing, they wouldn't explode and they'd get a better chance of survival. And that's what was happening. We thought that was terribly exciting. But then when we suddenly remembered that Mary was out walking, she would have been walking in that field somewhere nearby because she was going over to see her friend. So she went a bit hysterical, but anyway, Mary wandered in perfectly okay. And they'd exploded in a field or two away from where she was walking. All she thought was very funny was that when she was wandering on, Mary was always a bit of a sort of wanderer and dreamer. After the bombs had exploded, an old chap and a farm neighbour crept out from under a hedge and said to her, "Were they bombs?" So those were actually two of the first bits of action we saw, and this all happened before 1941, before we moved down to Somerset, with the village I told you about. This village was, apart from the fact that I know I'm really to tell you about the things I remember about the war, it was a village that was about a mile from the sea. It was the Bristol Channel. And when I said we remembered, I remember the summers very well, because we used to spend all our time down the beach. It was a big pebbly beach called Blue Anchor, and we used to go down there and swim and mess around all day practically sometimes, with Mummy used to give us sandwiches. Only the children, Mummy didn't come, she used to stay home with Jenny. When Jenny was a bit older, we used to take her as well, and we had it was just lovely. and we used to climb up the cliffs and eat all the old berries that we found all over the place. And I just remember always walking down these lovely little country lanes with our swimming costumes wrapped up in towels under our arms and perhaps some sandwiches. And that's how we used to spend our summers. I can't remember it ever really, but I'm sure it did. The most sort of remarkable thing was that all the fathers were away. There were hardly any men around at all, except in leave time, when they all used to come home all dashing in their uniforms. But it was a very romantic time, because all the men, husbands and lovers and boyfriends, were going away, and a lot of people got married very quickly, whereas they wouldn't have normally, so they'd be married before their husbands or their fiancés had to go away. And everything on the radio was all sort of about having to leave your loved ones behind. And I've written down some of the titles of the songs. They were all about one of them was called "We'll Meet Again," "Don't Know Where, Don't Know When," and these used to be sung on the radio all day. And another one, "I'll Remember You, My Darling, Though You're Far Across the Sea." Another one was "I never said thanks for that lovely weekend, those 2 weeks of heaven you asked me to spend." And it was all about how, you know, how people were being separated and how sad it was. And then there was a big one that was came more towards the end of the war, which you might have heard about. It was called "There'll Be Bluebirds Over the White Cliffs of Dover Tomorrow, Just You Wait and See." And "There'll be blue and fun and laughter and peace ever after tomorrow when the world is free." It's all about this sort of thing. And we never used to hear and a lot of them were just rehashed from the First World War, things like "It's a Long Way to Tipperary" and all those sort of things. "Wish Me Luck," oh, I've done that. "Wish Me Luck as You Wave Me Goodbye." I think that was a sort of First World War song as well. We all used to listen very, very anxiously for the news every day. I can remember the big sort of thing, the 6 o'clock news. We didn't actually have a radio for ages in our house, but we used to go sometimes and listen to it on Auntie Phil's radio. Because that was when they'd say, you know, what was happening in the war, what land had been gained and what had been lost, and how many aircraft were missing. It was always so many of our aircraft missing. One of our aircraft is, two of our aircraft is missing. And that was, you know, that was a very sort of emotive thing. And all because they didn't want to say, even when the war wasn't going well for us, you never heard anything like, "Oh dear, you know, we've had a really bad time." Everything was all trying to keep you buoyed up. And we used to go to the pictures, and there was this thing called a Pathé News, and it was always about the war, showing what was happening. It was different in those days. You never ever saw pictures of really nasty things happening, so somehow it was all a little bit of a sort of dream to us. Because nowadays, when they show pictures of the war and pictures in the paper, it shows people's dead bodies all over the place, but I never ever remember seeing a picture of anyone dead. So we sort of somehow thought nobody did. We knew they didn't. We thought they didn't really, because we never saw pictures of them. So everything was to try and keep everyone cheerful. There was a lot of things they used to say, like "careless talk costs lives," which was a big talk, a big saying, and there were posters all over the place in case there was a spy listening. If you said something about your father was going over to Italy, so then if a spy was listening, they know that sort of regiment was going over to Italy. So there was all this sort of thing about never talking about anything that was sort of in case a spy was listening, which we thought was very exciting. The other thing, of course, was that rationing was imposed. The government worked out very carefully how much each person actually required to live healthily, and keeping in mind the fact that there's tons of food you couldn't get because the convoys weren't getting in from other countries that used to bring over stuff that we needed. So because all the that was one of the big things that we used to do to each other, we to the Germans and they to us, was to, but more of them to us because we were an island, was to bomb all the ships that were bringing food in and supplies and oil and coal and stuff like that. So we sort of, there were a lot of things you just couldn't get, so actually we we sort of lived mainly on the food that we could produce in England, which was, when you think of it, was such a sensible thing. I don't know why we're not still doing it, but so there were certain things you couldn't get, like exotic fruits. I never saw bananas or oranges or anything like that, apples and pears, plums, things we grew in our own country. And of course, because there wasn't this sort of thing of being able to grow things at all times of the year and keep them preserved, and you just ate the food that was there at the time. In the summer you ate apples, and in the winter you ate apples if they were storers. That meant that you could keep them all the winter and store them. We used to keep them in the attic on newspapers, and that you could eat there during the winter. And all the vegetables that you grew in your own garden. There was a big campaign, it was called Dig for Victory, where everyone was told to dig up their flower borders and things and just grow vegetables. And I remember Mary won a prize, because you had to design a poster for Dig for Victory, and Mary won a prize for it. She was very good at drawing. And so then there was a certain amount of food you could get, and the government worked out, or whoever was the Minister of Food or something, that exactly how many vitamins, how many proteins, how much things everybody needed for their to live. And then you were given a ration book, and in the ration book there were coupons, and each coupon was a certain amount of things, like a coupon for 2 ounces of butter and a coupon for 4 ounces of margarine. You just got that once a week. And I can't remember the milk was ration. Bread wasn't ration, but we could usually get that. There wasn't sort of masses of stuff in the shops. You couldn't get lots of cakes and things like that. And you couldn't get sweets, of course, which is the thing that mostly interested us children. You could get them, but they were rationed. You just got so many sweets a week. And really, it was a very, very good system, because you never saw anybody fat, because everyone just had the same amount of food to eat. But you could get some, and you got a ration for a tin of beans and a ration for something or other, and potatoes I think you could always buy, and anyway lots of people grew potatoes and cabbages and stuff. The thing I remember mainly is people say, what a terrible time it was, we didn't have enough to eat, but I never remember being hungry, ever. There was always enough for us to eat. I don't know whether what happened in cities, maybe it was a bit different, but everybody had their rations in their ration books and things. You couldn't get cigarettes, which is another thing, because both my parents smoked, and that was another thing that was rationed. Actually, I don't think they were rationed, they just weren't around, and then suddenly the word would go around, hey, in certain shops you can buy cigarettes, and you'd be queuing for hours and hours and hours, and you'd get 10 cigarettes, and that perhaps last you for ages and ages. Things like makeup, which didn't affect us, but it affected Mary and Valerie, who were by that time sort of teenagers, and Mummy, who always was very glamorous and pretty. It wasn't easy to get makeup, so there were all sorts of tricks of what you could do to make up rouge or lipstick or something like that. And the other thing you couldn't get was stockings. I remember thin stockings, silk stockings, were very, very difficult to buy. You could buy them on the black market, meant you had to have lots of money. So I can remember Mummy, I think she always had stockings. She never used to walk in her stockings. If we were going out, she used to carry them in her handbag until we got to where we were going, and she'd slip behind the hedge and put her stockings on so that she could keep them longer. But Mary Valerie used to paint their legs. They used to paint them with a sort of dye that looked like stockings, and then because it was fashionable to have a seam up the back, we had to paint a seam up the back. It wasn't always very straight, but that was all that was all the sort of fun things that were happening. Let me think, what else? Because we were there, by that time we were living in this little village, it was just across the channel, the Bristol Channel. We could see Bristol and Cardiff on the other side, and of course they were cities that were very heavily targeted for bombing, so we used to get the bombs going over every night with that noise I was telling about, the funny noise. There'd be great banks of when we see them going across the sky very slowly, because there weren't any jets in that time, and those times. And then we'd see, if we stood at the end of our garden, you could see the fires and the lights and the explosions in Bristol and Cardiff on the other side of the channel on a clear day. What we were supposed to be doing was sitting under the stairs, which was where you were told to go if you didn't have an area shelter. you were told to go and sit under the stairs because they were very strongly built, and it was noticed that in the houses that were bombed in London, when the walls were all fallen down, the stairs were always standing. So we used to go under the stairs, which is actually a watching the fires, and we used to say, Mum, come back quickly, don't stay out there. But she did. There was never a particular danger. And remember I was telling you how the aeroplanes had to get rid of their ammunition if they were in trouble, they might crash or have to crash land. I can remember one night we were in bed and we could hear this aeroplane coming very close, and then a terrific noise, bullets shooting, and it was obviously very near, but we seemed to be okay. But the next morning when we got up, there was we used to have a thing called, we used to call it pants. And they'd gone straight to the roof and broken all the china plates. Luckily, missing all of us, were all asleep, well, probably not asleep in our beds, but certainly there. So that was quite exciting. That was a great story to tell the people at school the next day. Yeah, I'm at the end of this tape, so I'm going to finish now. There will be a little bit of a pause at the end of this tape, and then start from the other side. Recording, and then I'll start again. Yesterday I went down to Nelsworth. It was the date, the 5th of August 2006, it was a Saturday, and I went down to Nelsworth to to look around the places that I remember, and also to visit the graves of my parents, who were buried in Worcester Church Yard, by the monastery I told you about, where all the Dominican monks were, opposite the school. So I drove down, I took Mary with me, and we went first all up behind Worcester. There's a place called Selsley Common. There are lots of places called commons around where we lived. It was common land where anyone could graze their cattle or ride or walk, or and it's There's the Selsley Common, which is very, very high, and you can look right across into Wales from the top. And there's Minchin Hampton Common, which is the one that I remember mostly because it was very near to Nailsworth, and we used to go up there a lot on Sundays for a walk. Anyhow, Mary and I had a big walk up behind Selsley Common, and I remembered all the things that we used to do when we were children. Also, not very far away from there, I worked when I was a grown-up, when I was a nurse. And so we did all that. And then we went down into the graveyard, and we spent... It's very pretty, it's beautifully positioned. There's only the churches left now. The monastery's gone because not enough people wanted to be Dominican monks. So there's just the church left, and also the school where my mother taught. And I walked into the graveyard, sat for a little while in a seat overlooking the valley up onto the hill on the other side, by my mum's and dad's graves, and then I walked up to Grandma and Grandpa Watts, who are buried there, and also Uncle Harry and Auntie Josie, the person who was who made us all my mother become a Catholic. And then a little bit further up, my Grandma White, who is buried there, her husband, Grandpa White, who is the only grandparent I can remember. I can remember him very vaguely because he used to live with Auntie Phil in Old Cleve when we were there. But he died when I was about 9. It was a custom then, and still is for some people, to keep when a person has died, to keep their body in their coffins in the house until the funerals, usually sort of 4 or 5 days. And that's what Grandpa White, that's where Grandpa White was, in his bedroom in a coffin on a sort of trestle, and he had a kind of net instead of the lid of the coffin, which wasn't put on until just before the funeral. He had a net stretched across the top of the coffin, and we used to go and look at him for ages. He looked just as if he was asleep. And anyway, that's by the way. So I wandered around the churchyard for a bit, and I remember things that my mother told me, because just below there is where they used to live as children. I was looking at the little house where they used to live with the stream by. She said that she and Uncle Harold used to float their guinea pigs down the stream on a raft. And I said, and we used to say, what would happen if they fell off? And she said, oh, that's okay, they were really good swimmers. They just used to swim to the bank, and we used to rescue them. So that's what I did yesterday, and that was lovely. It was a beautiful day, and it was very, very full of memories for me. But anyway, back to Old Cleeve, and where we lived during the war. A lot of things. I mean, I can't really say that we had a hard war, because we didn't. But we were very aware of it all the time. As I said before, it was just totally part of our lives, what was happening. The two memorable things was when we were living. When we were living in Oakley, there were soldiers were billeted up in the town hall. They just made them into huge dormitories with all their kit and their camp beds and things. And they were just waiting there. I suppose they were waiting for orders to go off, possibly to D-Day, I should think. Thinking of the time it was, and for the D-Day landings. But they were terribly bored. They after they'd done all their sort of soldiering practices, they just used to sit around listening to music and chatting and doing nothing. And now we were asked if we would ever entertain in our houses. So Mummy sent Mary and Barry up to see if anyone would like to come down and play whist. And I remember these 8 soldiers came down, and they all, Mummy and Mary and Valerie probably, and them all sat round the table playing whist for ages and ages and having cups of tea and things like that. That was quite exciting. We thought it was very exciting having soldiers in the house. The other thing nothing to do with soldiers, but the other things that we did in the village hall, because I told you there was in the village a great load of my cousins lived there, all the cousins on my father's side. And my aunt Phil, she was the person who was the headmistress at St Dominic's School when Mummy and Daddy met. She was a very great organiser, and she and Aunt Dora, who used to play the piano, they got us some. There was 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 children, 11 of us. So they organised a wonderful concert when we all did acts, and they made us costumes out of various bits of pieces of old black curtain and dyed butter muslin. And as far as I remember, the things that we mostly did were acting out old music hall songs and things, other songs that were sort of folk songs. We all had to do acting, and then we did the Walrus and the Carpenter, the whole poem. By from Alice, and we all had to dress up, and I think I was I can't remember, something really boring, like a fish or a winkle or something. But anyway, they were terrifically good fun, and all the villagers used to come and see us, and I think probably they were very good, actually, because Aunt Phil was very good at making children do things. And then talking about blackout curtains, and I said we used to make the costumes out of it. I didn't tell you that you weren't allowed to show any light at night, and wherever in the whole of England you were never allowed to show any lights at night, so everybody had to have blackout curtains. So it was issued in enormous quantities, and we all had to buy it and make these big curtains that we fitted over the windows at night, so that no light showed at all, so that if any German planes were going over, they couldn't see anything to bomb it. And we were always very careful about the putting up the blackout curtains. And there were people called air raid wardens. Even in our little tiny village, we had an air raid warden. And they used to go around and knock on the door if they could see any light coming out of your window. at the very end of the war, after the end of the war in Europe, we were told we didn't have to have blackout curtains up anymore. But I can remember Lucia and I were in the house one evening, and Mummy had gone out somewhere, perhaps along the road to see some friends, and we were in the house and it was dark, and we didn't have the blackout curtains up because this was a great thing, you didn't have to have them up anymore. But we heard an aeroplane going over, so we rushed the window and put the blackout curtains up just in case. So we were so used to thinking about having them up, we just couldn't believe that we wouldn't be able to, we wouldn't be bombed by Germans even though the war was over. So anyway, the British troops went eventually from the village hall, and then the next big exciting thing happened when the Americans came. They were so glamorous. They had wonderful uniforms to start with. They were made of very much better material than our soldiers' material was, and they all looked very tall and handsome and healthy. And they talked, and because we'd only other Americans we'd ever met were people, or ever heard or seen, were people on films, because we were huge film fans. We used to go to the cinema every Saturday and watch whatever was on in Minehead. And anyway, they were just like film stars. The other interesting thing with the arrival of Americans was the first black people we ever saw, the black Americans. We were completely fascinated by them. They were always chewing gum, and they used to give gum to all the children when they saw us. And they used to have, it probably was only one Christmas that they were stationed over here, because they came over here also ready for the D-Day landings. And they gave great big children's parties at Christmas time, and we all went, and there was stuff there that we'd never seen before, because they used to send over food from America to the soldiers, or they used to bring it over when they came, that we hadn't ever seen before, and sweets and jellies and ramones and cakes and biscuits and crisps and chewing gum, which is a great big thing. And they were very, very glamorous. They were also, there always used to be big dances up at the village halls and all the surrounding village halls for these soldiers and all the local young girls. And so Mary and Valerie used to go to all these. And I can remember sitting at the table watching them get ready to go out in the evenings, putting on all their makeup and doing their hair up by the light of the oil lamp, and then seeing them go off. And of course they used to bring soldiers home, because they were very pretty and they had boyfriends who were soldiers. So as we were the young children, we were made a great fuss of by these American soldiers who were probably trying to curry favour with us so that our sisters would like them. Two of them who came home, they were a little bit older than the others, and they were terribly nice, and they used to draw things for us, Lister and I, and one of them had been was an illustrator for the Saturday Evening Post, which is a very famous, I don't know that it's on still now, but a very famous American magazine that we used to love to have, and we used to get from them sometimes. I can remember him drawing beautiful women and then changing them into horses and then putting hats on them and all this sort of thing, all with these beautiful strokes. It always makes me sad now to think that we didn't keep them, because they would have been terribly interesting to have. But they used to come when they used to call for our sisters, then they always used to go off out, and Mummy used to go out as well often for the dances, and she used to know a lot of American soldiers. They were always officers, they were always slightly better than the actual soldiers, and my auntie Phil used to be furious because she thought that Mummy was behaving a bit loosely when her husband was away in the army. But actually Daddy knew, of course, and was quite happy for Mummy to go out if she couldn't go out. But then they all listened, Mummy and Mary and Valerie always to go off together all the dances and have a lovely time. That was a very exciting time for us. The other thing that they used to do, they used to bring us stuff. I remember one of them he worked in the cookhouse, and he bought a sack of flour which was like coal dust, and it lasted ages and ages, and it used to get weevils in it because we only had this little very sort of damp cottage. They used to pick out the weevils before we made cakes and things with this flour and sugar. They used to bring sugar. And when we were waiting at the bus stop to go to school in the morning, we used to see the convoys of soldiers going down the road, and the Americans used to throw things out at us, or us children waiting at the bus stops. They used to throw out sweets, and then we used to catch them all. They were like sort of gods. The other thing was that one of them was a pilot, and they used to have little aeroplanes called Piper Cubs, and I suppose in the war they were used just for reconnaissance. And one of Mary of Lovella's boyfriends was a pilot. And he used to swoop over the house and drop things into the garden. And once he dropped a pound of butter, which was just absolutely wonderful. Luckily, it didn't splash all over the floor. It just, because they used to fly very low, and so this is that was a great treasure. And one of the soldiers that Valerie used to know well, and we got to know him really well, he was killed in the D-Day landings. But generally, we didn't actually know many people who got killed in the war. I don't remember any of my friends' fathers being killed or wounded, which was extraordinary when you think of it, wasn't it? The lady who house we were renting, her husband was in the army, but he came back as well. I didn't say that, but my mummy was a great trailblazer. She was always had an Irish fashion, and she was the first person to have a permanent wave in her hair in the village, and also she used to wear lipstick. And another thing she did was she was the first person to wear trousers, and she was thought of as rather a scarlet woman. Of course, all the women in the village, all the old farmers' wives and cow ladies and things, used to spread all sorts of terrible tales about her, that she was a harlot, but all the men thought she was absolutely marvellous, and that's probably why the women were so cross with her. And also she smoked, which is a very modern thing to do. We were terribly proud of her. We were always longing for her to come into school and meet us in school, because she was just so different from and modern compared to a lot of the other mothers. So we were very proud of her. I told you Jane was a great favourite among us, and we were always. She was born in 1941, and so she was five or so when the war ended. But four when the war ended. We used to teach her to do all sorts of things. She'd say "dirty Germans," and then she used to go, "What a smasher!" which was, and roll her eyes and waggle her bottom and turn around. We thought it was terribly funny. Of course, other people thought she was probably a little brat. But she was very appreciative. We thought she was marvellous. One of the things that the chap used to come and help Mummy with the garden, one of the things he used to do was to, he used to grow lots of spinach. He used to call it spinach. And he grew rows and rows and rows. It was absolutely more than we could possibly eat. It's the great thing about spinach is you can eat it all during the winter. So it grew up really high like a forest, and we used to play soldiers among it, crawling along on our tummies with our wooden guns and things. And so eventually I think he gave up on us and didn't plant any more spinach. We used to have lots of cats. In those days, I hate people saying those days, but it wasn't common for the ordinary people to have their animals spayed, because it was quite expensive. And so what happens is when they had young kittens, the cats particularly, I was thinking of, because we had cats, we just had to drown them. It sounds awful, but we just used to drown them as soon as they were born. But when Daddy went away to the war, we never had the nerve to drown them ourselves, so our cats kept having kittens, and we kept keeping them. And one time we had 15 cats. They were all beautiful, of course, and we used to line up the food in a row. We didn't have proper fruit, so we used to get our rubbish from the butcher, sort of ends of stuff, and Mummy used to boil it up, and we used to mix it up with bread and stuff, and give it to the cats. They weren't spoiled, the kitty cats and things like that, like they are nowadays. And then whatever the rest they were hungry, they used to catch mice and hunt in the fields. But because I remember two of the cats particularly remembering the days when their kittens used to be drowned, which of course didn't realise that they weren't anymore, had their kittens in the fields, and secretly we knew they'd had them because they obviously got thin and started having huge teats, but we couldn't ever find them. But then on two occasions I remember the cats bringing them in when they were about a few weeks old, their eyes were open, and they were running around and much too pretty to drown. So they were very canny. They knew perfectly well we'd have to keep them then. So there we had these 15 cats. Goodness knows what happened to them, because at the end of the war there were particular ones that the sort of grandma of them all called Kitty, very originally, which we took with us. But when we moved away from Old Cleve at the end of the war, because the person who were renting us the house wanted to come back, of course, her husband was coming out of the army, we only took about two of the cats with them. All the rest were just sort of wild around the village. I don't suppose we were very popular, come to think of it. So we moved away from O'Keeffe in 1945. We were going back to live in Gloucestershire, where we all came from. Because we didn't have anywhere to live, and Daddy was still in the army, Mummy and Lissa and Valerie were going to go and live up, and Jenny were going to go and live up with Ma and Winnie, who lived in Forest Green, a pretty village above Lanesworth, and I was going to stay for the time being with Auntie Josie, the famous Irish lady, because I was her goddaughter. So I went to stay with her, and all the others went up to Auntie Winnie's. This was just so we could find somewhere to live. I forgot to say that about a year or so before, I can't exactly remember the time, Mary was old enough to join the Wrens. So she left home then and went, and she joined the Wrens. And she was stationed in London, I think, a lot of the time. We weren't sorry to see the back of her because she was a terrible bully to us, and it was quite nice and peaceful to be without her. But Mummy, of course, was very upset because it was her oldest daughter and she was the first one to leave home. She didn't actually come home to live again, Mary, because while she was in the Wrens, she met another girl who became a great friend called Tatty. And when after they came out of Wrens, Tatty's stepfather started at what was then used to be called sort of roadhouses, a bit like roadhouses were a bit smarter, but transporting cabins where people just stopped as they went along on journeys. He started this cafe, and Mary and Tatty went to work in it while they were thinking of what they were going to do. Mary then got a place because she played piano beautifully. She worked while she was living with Tatty and her family, and got a scholarship to the Trinity College of Music in London. So then she went to live in London, so she never really came home to live again. So we were all back in Nailsworth, and that was when the war in Japan ended in the east, and that was completely the end of the war. That was the war against the Japanese people that was fought in the Pacific, a lot of it by the Americans. So there was a huge celebration then, and we had in Nailsworth in the recreation grounds, we had a big celebration, and there was a sort of sports day, and I won a running race and won half a crown, and everybody was very excited, and everyone was coming home. And interestingly enough, my Auntie Joseph's oldest son Tom had been a Japanese prisoner of war for years and years, and he was going to come home from the Japanese prisoner of war camp, and that was terribly exciting, because I don't know whether you read about it or know about it, but the Japanese prisoners of war were treated very, very badly, the English people who were by the Japanese, as thousands and thousands of them died, and a lot of them were employed in making the famous railway in Thailand, where your parents lived, and we actually used to go and see when we went to stay with them. And so Tom was coming home from the Japanese prisoner of war camp, and the whole street was waiting to welcome him. And that's when I was going to not be able to live there anymore, because I was sleeping in his bedroom, but we were all there. There were great big banners across the road. He probably hated it because he probably just wanted to creep home and be peaceful, but he came home, he was terribly thin, and the only two possessions he had were a rosary that he'd made out of dried berries, and a bit of a knife that he'd managed to sharpen so sharply that he could shave himself. So he came home, and he was a great hero figure, and like a lot of young men who came home at that time, they had a bit like they were about the footballers of today, they had their pick of all the glamorous girls. He bought a sports car and had a series of very, very glamorous girlfriends, but eventually he settled down. So that was the end of our war, Lily. My daddy didn't come home until 1947. He stayed on in the army, and he used to be on the troop ships that were transporting all the troops back from various parts of the world, and he used to go out to India and come back and forth from India. He absolutely loved India. He used to send us letters describing the things that they'd done. I can't believe that we haven't got them. They were just like stories, and it was such a glamorous idea to us who've never hardly ever been out of our own villages. And when he came home on leave, he used to bring big trunks of things that we couldn't get in England still. I mean, it sounds a bit boring, but sheets and sandals and cotton things and marshmallows. I always remember the marshmallow, big boxes of marshmallow. They're still rationing. They continued to be rationing for many years after the war until everything settled down again. So all those things were very, very good and exciting. And then and because we still didn't have anywhere to live, it was arranged that Dowley went back to Minehead to live with some friends because she had a job there working in a solicitor's office in Minehead. So she went there, and Lister and I, it was arranged that we went back as boarders to the school that we were day girls at in Minehead called St. Teresa's. So until we could find, well, we did it because we didn't really have anywhere to live. Mummy was staying with Auntie Winnie, with Jenny. Daddy was away, Valerie was away, Mary was away. And we just had to go back there for the holidays. But eventually we managed to get, the great thing about the at the end of the war was there just wasn't enough housing for all the people who needed it. Tons and tons of places had been bombed and destroyed, of course. But apart from that, you know, there were all these young married soldiers who got married during the war, people who got married, all needed somewhere to live. So it was very, very difficult to find anywhere to live, and we never owned a house. It just wasn't, it wasn't very common to own your own house. We'd always rented. So eventually we rented, I think it started off as three rooms in an old ex-pub in Nailsworth in a place called Cossack Square. It was a huge old building with great big rooms, and we had one room downstairs and then a bedroom on the first, going up the first landing, and then at the very top we had a huge attic bedroom where we all used to sleep. So by that time, Lissa finished school. And so she came back and went to the art school in Minehead in Stroud, and she lived at home with Mummy and Jenny. But I stayed on as a boarder, which I absolutely hated, actually. I was so unhappy. So that really was that as far as the war went. But I thought, we don't have to listen to the next, but I thought I might just tell you a little bit of our lives up until I got married anyway, and I was the last one to get married. So I'm just going to give you a quick rundown after that time. So we were all back living in Nailsworth, if you remember, in Cossack Square, in these rooms. Our landlady was a funny old chap called Mr. Creed, and his wife died, and he married this awful woman called Zoo. She's really called Sue. She used to wear a hat all the time, which it was fashionable at the time. They were called beanies, but she used to call it her beady. She always used to get everything wrong when she spoke. But although we were living, and we lived there for some years, from 1946 or so, probably until, gosh, I can't remember, 1950, 52 or something like that, about six or seven years, although we lived in these rooms, which was just one room and two bedrooms I told you about, and shared a kitchen which was really just a scullery with a sink and a coal tap and a very, very old gas stove and one lavatory with there were about three other families living in the house. It was an extremely happy time. I just remember it as a very, very happy time of our lives. But for one thing, we were back again in our own place, and we'd put some what furniture we'd put in store during the war, and we had it back again, and we were living with our own furniture. Mainly we had the piano and our table and all that sort of thing, and it was just a lovely time. I went on being a boarder for a bit while Lisa was at the art school, but then I eventually left in 1947 or so. I came home and started going to school in Stroud at St. Rose's Convent, actually the convent school where my big sisters had been boarders before the war, and then I took my school certificate there and left from that school when I was 16. And Jenny went there as well. 1947, there we met Ken, her husband, who was in the Navy, and he was a friend. He was a brother of somebody she worked with. By that time, Barry had come home and was living at home as well in Cossack Square, working in Newman Henders, which is a big factory just down the hill from St. Dominic's Monastery, which I mentioned many times before. And she fell in love with Ken. She was only 18. And well, he fell heavily for her, and he was going to be away for 2 years. He was going on tour to Egypt and Palestine. There was still sort of trouble out there, and he was he was in the Navy, but he was affiliated with the Royal Marines at the time. So they were in love and he was going away for 2 years. The only way they could work it out was if they got married, and after 6 months she could go and join him in Malta. They were going to live in Malta. So that's what they did. We weren't very fond of Belle. She was a bit of a big sister and always sort of pushing us around a bit. So I can remember us pleading to Mummy, come, Mummy, let her marry him. And so they got married, and she was the first one in the family to get married, which was a huge occasion. Mary's a little bit miffed because she always thought she should have been the first one to get married, but she came down from London and she always had sort of latest things on, so that we were in awe of her a bit. And they had a very quiet wedding. They just wore tidied up clothes that they had. I think Barry bought a hat, because the other thing was that you couldn't get many clothes anymore, because they were all rationed as well, so you had to save up so many coupons before you could buy anything new. So Mary was the maid of honour and Daddy came home on leave, and they were married at St Dominic's, as we all were, in fact, in the end. And so we thought it was wonderful. Lister and I were still boarders at that time, so we had a great story to tell when we went back after the holidays. They were married on the 27th of December, and afterwards we all went down to the local pub and had a drink and made merry. And then Ken went away, but Valerie, they went back for their honeymoon to Minehead, and then he went off, but Valerie continued to stay at home. I remember a painful incident, because Valerie used to play the violin and quite well, but listening to someone practicing the violin is never the most wonderful thing. And because he was a sailor, she learned how to play for those in peril on the sea. And every night she used to play for those in peril on the sea with her violin, and Lisha and I used to stand very, very obviously with our fingers in our ears and things. We were such nasty children. So there we were. Daddy was still away in the he came out of the army, but he continued to live in Birmingham, where he'd been stationed a lot of the war. He never actually fought in the Second World War because he was too old, but he stayed up there because he got a job there, and he just used to come home at the weekends. So we were all living in Coswick Square, Mummy, Lissa, Valerie, Jenny and I. Lissa was at art school, I was at St Rose's, and at that time the monastery still had lots of young priests and novices, and we used to have lots of fun down there. We started a youth club with all the youth of the area. They were all Catholics, and I have kept in touch with a lot of them still. And we used to have club every Tuesday and Friday night, I think it was, and we used to do very exciting and adventurous things with the club. We used to go off and have picnics, and we used to swim. There was a place called Worcester Park, which is now all done up and very smart, but at that time it was had an interesting history. It was built by the man who built the church, and he ran out of money halfway through building. It was a massive mansion, Worcester Mansion, and it had never been finished. It had always stayed in this state of half-finishedness. I can remember the stair. There was a huge staircase that was swept up and ended in nothing, just a big drop. And there was a ballroom that had been roofed, actually. We used to go and look at, and it was in the middle of a huge park with five lakes in it, and we used to go up and swim in the lakes. And nowadays, I think people would be absolutely horrified, but we used to a great crowd of youngsters used to go up and swim in these old muddy lakes with nobody, no grown-ups there or anything. We used to have to fight your way through the water lilies to get to clear water to swim. And also we used to go and poke around and play around this huge old mansion. One of the things that we used to do was go up at night, if it was moonlight. We used to go up there, or meet about 8 or 9 o'clock, and walk up. It was about a mile, I suppose, from the gates up to the mansion. We used to walk up into the moonlight and all play ghosts and things around this old ruined place. So the club played a very big part in our lives. We used to put on pantomimes at Christmas time and do them all in the village hall. And we used to go up to London sometimes and go to art galleries and things. The priest used to take us. So that was a big part of my sort of growing up into teenage. So when I was 16, I took my school certificate and passed it reasonably. And I knew I wanted to be a nurse. I'd always wanted to be a nurse. So I wanted to leave school because I didn't want to do any further education, and having school is difficult, was considered to be quite enough to get a job. So I got a job in a little draper's shop up the road in Nailsworth called Plots. It was a very old-fashioned draper shop, even by those days' standards, with a very old-fashioned chap. He was about 80 who owned it. He'd come down from somewhere like Wimbledon, and he'd always had draper shops. And I used to work in there with a girl called Joan Davis, who was a daughter of some great friends of Mummy and Daddy. And that was very good fun that time. That 2 years in the draper shop, measuring out cloth and selling clothes, and I used to get my own clothes there. I once got a very nice overcoat. It was a man's overcoat, but it was tweed, and I thought it was very fashionable. It had raglan sleeves, and that was passed around the whole family. If anyone was going to do anything that they wanted to look at least it smart, they all used to wear my overcoat. And Mary Boyd had actually to go on a honeymoon. And Mary by this time had married Tony up in London. We didn't go to their wedding. We weren't invited. They were a bit sort of smart and arty, and wasn't considered to be the thing to have lots of sisters and things at your wedding. So they married in London. He was doing art as he is now, but he didn't actually make any money, so he worked as a hospital porter. And then Mary had Stephen, and we used to go up and visit her. And we thought that was when we started going to London, really. She used to take us, Sweetly used to take us to things like the zoo and places like that. And I remember going to a restaurant, out for a restaurant once with her. I'd never been out to a restaurant before. It was really, I didn't know how to contain my excitement. Meanwhile, Jenny had become a horse. She was, we used to have a railway line that came up to Nailsworth at that time from Stonehouse, and then went on to the main lines. And what happened was that all the freight used to be brought on the railway to the station, and there was a horse, a beautiful old cart horse there, and a dray, which is a big flat cart, and all the stuff used to be loaded onto the dray that was for Nailsworth for the shops and hotels and things, and then the horse used to pull it around various shops delivering it. And Jenny and her friend Jill Carey got very friendly with the chap who used to do the horse. I can't remember his name now, but the horse used to be stabled up at the station. He used to live there, and they used to go around and mess around with it, and they became absolutely completely obsessed with horses. We used to go by at Stowe, which was in Gloucestershire, big horse fair. We used to be able to buy a colt for about, I don't know, £2 or £3. And then Jenny always had a little colt. She used to bring it home, and because it was country, she could keep it in the fields of farmers for next to nothing. And then when it grew up, she'd ride it. Sometimes she used to look after other people's horses and ride them. But before they had horses of their own, Jenny and Jill were actually horses themselves. They used to gallop everywhere and snort and toss their heads and run all sideways when they saw anybody on the pavement in their way and look out of the corners of their eyes. We used to be so ashamed going anywhere with them, because they never went anywhere, but they weren't galloping or trotting or eating out of bags of oats and snorting and whatever. Just they were horses. What I didn't mention was that about that time Bella had moved, had gone away and gone to live in Malta, and then eventually Egypt. And while she was out there, she had Robin, and that was a huge milestone in all our lives, having a nephew. He was born when Jenny was 7, and I was 12, I think. And so really, it was just like another, it was just sort of going on to more and more babies, because it didn't seem long since Jenny was born, and there wasn't a big difference between Robin and Jenny. So Mummy and Valerie were both mothers of young children at the same time. And she came home, and they went to live up in a little village called Pinfarthings, which funnily enough was the village where my grandma was brought up, Grandma Watts. And they rented a tiny little cottage up there, and next door to Ken's parents, who lived up there also. And so we thought that was interesting, because we then had another home that we could go to, is we used to go up and visit Valerie quite a lot and play with Robin and make a huge fuss of him. He was our next plaything after Jenny. And then Lisa went away to teach training college. So in the end, it was just Grandma and Jenny living in Cossack Square, Daddy coming home at weekends, and Valerie living up in Pinfarthing. I always knew I wanted to be a nurse, and I knew I couldn't start my career until I was 18. I'd fixed up myself to do it in Bournemouth, where they had a very good training school for nurses. When I was the summer that I was 18, I was 18 in February, and it was August, I went off down to Bournemouth to start my training as a nurse. I was dreadfully homesick. I can't ever remember being so absolutely desolate, and the only reason really I stayed was because everyone said, "Oh no, you won't stick it out. You know, you're not strong enough to be a nurse," and all those sort of things. So I was absolutely determined I wasn't going to go home, but I was dreadfully unhappy. We had 6 weeks in a preliminary training school. We didn't go on the wards at all, and then we started to go on the wards, and then ever after that we were on the wards, and I did that. The training lasted for 3.5 years. It was a very old-fashioned training, but one I thought was absolutely wonderful, much better than the nurses training today, but I won't go into that. It was quite hard, very Victorian sort of attitudes, but I knew that Lisa, by that time, Lisa and Bert had decided to get, Lisa met Bert when she was away at teacher training college, and they wanted to get married, and they were going to get married in December. So I went away in August, and then I didn't go home again until just after Christmas, when I got some time off to part of my holiday to go to Lisa and Bert's wedding, so I went home for the first time. And it was a freezing cold day, I can remember. Mainly about it was absolutely freezing, but anyway, it was a lovely wedding, but I had to go back that night, so I just had one night at home, then this was wedding, and then that evening they all came to see me off again back to Bournemouth, and I knew I wasn't going to be able to go home again for about another 6 months, because we were paid so little, there's no chance of ever getting enough for a fare to go home, so it was quite hard, but by that time I was getting used to it, and so that lasted for the next 3.5 years. I left my training. I got my state registered nursing certificate at the end of 3 years, but we had to stay on for another half a year as staff nurses in the hospital. So I did. I've stayed there down in Bournemouth. By this time I was living in a flat with three other girls. We had to do the first 2 years. We had to live in the nurses' hospital, which was absolutely dreadful. But after that we were able to move out to a flat, so we had a nice flat and at the top of a three-story house, and it was just two big rooms, a big bedroom and a big sitting room. We all managed to squash in there, and had quite good fun. We used to have parties and boyfriends and things. But at the end of about when I was about to leave, about 2 weeks before I was due to leave, actually longer than that, about a month before I was due to leave, the matron told me off for having holes in my stockings, and you couldn't actually see them. Only very, very faintly, because they were quite high above my skirt line, and she told me to go take the morning off as my off-duty, when I was actually supposed to be having an evening off, and go and buy some new stockings. I was so absolutely furious, because I knew I was only had about another month to go, and we were very hard up, and it meant that I'd have to buy these black stockings that I'd never wear again. So I went back to the flat. I was so cross. I went back again. And she said, "Come and see me with your new stockings on at lunchtime." I mean, I was 21, a proper grown-up. We were treated just like skivvies. So I went into her office and said, "I haven't bought any stockings and I'm leaving." And I walked out and didn't ever go back again, so I missed my last month's pay. But I went and got Bournemouth, a huge holiday place, and it's full of enormous hotels. So I went straight down and got myself a job as a chambermaid in one of the hotels, which paid, you know, helped me to pay the rent and everything for the next month, and then I went back to live at home. Just after I started my training, Grandma, Mummy wrote to say that they'd found this sweet little cottage in a place called Kinnebottom. It was standing in a field all by itself, and they were going to buy it. It was the first house they'd ever owned, and it was £150. And so when I went home, the next time I was due home, probably a few months later, it was the springtime, and she took me along to show me. It was about a mile and a half out of Nailsworth. It wasn't on the main road. You had to go the main route through Horsley or Newmarket, the two villages that were nearest to it, and then you had to walk across some couple of fields, and it was absolutely beautiful. With the second field leading up to the cottage was had a stream running on one side of it, and I always remember there were primroses growing all on the bank on the other side. And then up on the right there's a beautiful sloping field with cows in, and at the top beechwoods that went for miles, and beyond the cottage, it was about another half mile after you went off the road, they just stretched on forever and ever, and finally ended up in Nimsfield, which is a few miles away, just this flat, completely empty valley. So we were just living in this beautiful isolated place, and that was terribly exciting. So but over the course of the next few couple of years, I used to go home for my holidays there, and then whenever I eventually went home, that's where we were living in Kenley Bottom, and we lived there for the next, I don't know, about 10 years, I think. But I got a job locally because it was so lovely to be home again. So I got a job first working in a nursing home just while I was killing time looking around, and as a registered nurse. And then I got a job in a big sanatorium about 11 miles away from where we lived, in a place called Stonehouse. It was called Standish. It was at the time when people who had tuberculosis had to be isolated in these huge sanatoriums, and they had at one point in time there was no cure except fresh air and good food, and you just hoped that it and rest, and you hoped it might get you might get better. A lot of people didn't, but then they, by the time I went to nurse there, they discovered some wonder drugs. So although people still had to stay in for sometimes up to a year, and you know, be on bed rest and weren't allowed to do anything, and we used to wheel them out in their beds onto the big balconies every morning, whatever the weather, and but they were cured by the drugs that we were giving them. So I worked there for about a year and a half while it was a sanatorium, and then I went to Jamaica to live for a bit, and had a lovely time there. Went out because a boyfriend was there, but I didn't actually stay with that boyfriend, so I went out and had a very jolly time in Jamaica for a year, and then I moved on to Canada for another year. And lived there working in a bank. Actually, I didn't work as a nurse in either of those places. I worked in a shop, a very smart tourist dress shop in Jamaica, because it was full of American tourists, and I worked in a bank rather disastrously in Canada, and it was there that I met Grandpa. After I'd been in Canada for a while, I decided I'd like to come home again. My daddy was very ill, so in fact, we found out later that he had cancer, lung cancer. And so I came home, went back to live in Kinney Bottom, went back to work in Standish, which had changed from a sanatorium to an orthopaedic hospital. So I stayed there until I got married in 1962. And that's another whole story. So I'll stop there. I remember a couple more things that used to happen during the war. All the country was sort of, I told you, we did this sort of dig for victory thing where everyone had to help with the war effort by living off the land. And it was at that time when they thought that rose hip syrup was terribly good for children because it was very, very high in vitamin C. And so it was a thing that was given naturally to young babies. And I think it was given naturally free through the government. So we all used to go, all of us, and all my cousins and I, with my aunt Phil, Auntie Phil, used to go on huge expeditions in the autumn, picking bags and bags and bags of rose hips after the wild roses had gone, and then they were all parcelled up and sent off to your local sort of centre, and then they were made into rose hip syrup, which was distributed to babies at the time. That was during the war. And the other thing I remember doing was, which was quite funny, with Mr. Churchill, who was Prime Minister at the time, his wife, Mrs. Churchill, had a fund, was called Aid to Russia, because it was a time when Russia was having a really bad time fighting the Germans, and lots of people were terribly hard up. And she started a sort of charity where we all had to send things out to Russia. I remember going, a big gang of us from the village, going around carousing, starting it about November, for the Aid to Russia funds. I don't know how much we could. I think the tape's ending now, darling, so I'll say goodbye. Bye. Lily, I'm going to add a few things because I can't remember exactly what I told you before about when I was a little girl during the war. I don't remember that I told you that when I was about six and we moved out to live in Dorset for a bit, I went to stay with a lady who was a landlady of the house that we lived in, and she lived up in Ash, funnily enough. We'd never even heard of it before. I don't know why I went to stay with her. I thought she was old. She was probably about 56 or something. Didn't have any children of her own. I suppose she took a fancy to me, and Mummy said I could go and stay with her. But because it was the time when the bombers were going over to London, there was always a lot of stuff going on during the night, and we used to have to sleep. Two things I remember mostly about staying with her. We used to have to sleep under the bed because it was supposed to be a bit safer. And I used to have to sleep on the inside with her on the outside. It was absolutely horrible. I hated it. But she kind of made it a bit better for me by letting me play with a beautiful doll that she had. So I used to take it to bed with me under the bed there. And then the other thing I can remember about staying with her, sitting in a front room of some niece or other house, while they all talked and drank tea, and I was just sitting there. That's all I can remember about staying with her. It was such an odd occasion. But the other thing is that at the end, at the very end of the tape, Grandpa's going to splice this into my wartime memories. At the very end of the tape, I wanted to say that it's funny how different people remember different things, and that if ever any of my sisters heard this tape, they'd probably think, or keep saying, no, it wasn't then, no, that was 1941, and no, it wasn't Mummy who said that, it was Daddy, and that sort of thing. So this is just how I remember everything, but it might not be absolutely accurate, but it's accurate enough. All right then, darling. I'll close again.